The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Monday, November 28, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, and we thank you so much for listening. Donald Trump, the president-elect of the United States, says more than 2 million people voted illegally in the presidential election. He said there's serious voter fraud in Virginia, New Hampshire, and California. There's no evidence for any of this aside from a conspiracy theory on the internet. But it sounds like the person who won the election by less than 100,000 votes across 4 swing states would like a recount. Of course, Donald Trump does not want a recount, but that isn't stopping false claims from undermining the integrity of an election that he won. Nevertheless, today, election officials in Wisconsin meet to come up with a timeline for a recount of that state's presidential vote. The Clinton campaign agreed to participate in a vote recount that was spearheaded by Green Party candidate Jill Stein. That request was approved in Wisconsin. Michigan and Pennsylvania could join in later on. Purvi Vora is a professor of computer science at George Washington University. She says the recount in Wisconsin or other states isn't about changing the outcome so much as it's about assuring voter integrity and confidence.
It's not enough to say, oh, the voting system said this, let's get on with our lives. It's, this is what the voting system says, and now I have some evidence that was verified by voters, and that's durable and has been securely stored for the purpose of examination. And we treat our democracy seriously, we treat the outcome of our election seriously, and so we are going to examine the votes. We don't send a message to the world that technology decides our elections. Our voters decide our elections. And that's a very strong message we want to send. It's not about changing the outcome. It's that we take our elections seriously. We are a rational country, scientifically advanced. We take our democracy seriously. And this is what science says, in the interests of the outcomes today and in the future, we will audit our elections. I think that's what it's about.
You know, Purvi Vora, it seems like we have these two different groups of people ever since the election. We have the computer scientists, people like you, who say the science doesn't lie, audits should always be performed, let's deal with this rationally. You have the election watchers and professional vote counters and analysts who've gone back into the voting results, let's say in Wisconsin, and have said, everybody relax, this has nothing to do with hacking. Differences in education and race and voter patterns fully explain why voting patterns were different between computerized ballots and paper ballots. It's because of the voters, not because of hacking, and you're all being stupid.
Statistical patterns are not evidence, right? So the statistics could be different, and you could still have a good election, or the statistics might be the same, and you have a bad election. Because looking at this, you know, at polls and looking at statistical patterns in the ballots is not the same in the outcomes, is not the same as looking at the ballots. The ballots are the evidence. Now, you know, it's possible that you might have a very different election from what was expected and that it's the will of the voters. You might have the same election as last year and it may not be the will of the voters. And so it's not really so much about patterns and stuff. That is not really looking at the evidence, and that's besides the point. I don't think we should have to look at that and explain the statistical irregularities or irregularities or whatever. We should actually be looking at the evidence. That's the ballots. You know, it's not about patterns in the data. And so I think that claim was part of an article, but it wasn't made by, for example, Professor Holloman, who is a specialist in security of voting machines. So it's really not, I think that's a distraction, the statistical pattern and whether it's supported by demographics and education level and so on, and actually what the ballots say. Because I think what the ballots say is more important. And the ballots may support strange statistics and they may support decent, regular, run-of-the-mill statistics, you know. And that we can only know if we look at the ballots.
A recount of the presidential election will proceed in Wisconsin and maybe in other states like Ohio and Pennsylvania as well. But a growing number of computer scientists and data professionals like Professor Purvivura are calling for regular audits of the election system to verify that they have integrity. Purvivura is professor of computer science at George Washington University. Professor, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Donald Trump is set to take office in a situation unlike any other president in modern history. Trump has business holdings and active business relationships in at least 20 countries, likely many more. And that means that his financial fortunes rest with countries where the United States has national security interests, with politicians who can control his deals or curry favor with investors, and with business partners who, in many cases, are agents of those very governments. Now, Donald Trump told the New York Times that the law is on his side here. The president can't have a conflict of interest. Well, while he's right that in most cases government ethics rules don't apply to the president, aside from some big exceptions in the Constitution, in fact, anyone can have a conflict of interest. That's when your interests conflict, whether you get in legal trouble for them or not. And a new sweeping report out from the New York Times details a lot of what can be known about Donald Trump's financial interests around the world and how they could affect the U.S. national interest. Eric Lipton is a Washington-based investigative reporter with our partner, the New York Times. He's been spending a lot of time covering the president-elect's business interests and potential conflicts of interest. He's a co-author of that broad piece, along with several other reporters.
The thing that's sort of interesting about the role that Donald Trump is going to play in the United States is that we're a country that for the last several decades has really been pushing other governments around the world to separate political power from economic power. We have something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is trying to, you know, create more transparency in governments. It's trying to prevent any payments for permits or other or payments for contracts. And we've been preaching that, you know, you really need to have a transparent government. Where the people, you don't want to have the government of the oligarchs, where people have both political power and economic power. And now, I'm not at all suggesting that Donald Trump is an oligarch, but there is a centralization of economic and political power that he represents, which is going to sort of undermine a lot of the former State Department people we spoke with. The argument that the United States is making is that there needs to be a division, and that one, you know, the people in control of the government should also not be in control of major chunks of the economy.
So you go all over the world in this piece. You mentioned Brazil, you mentioned India, Azerbaijan, a bunch of different places. But let's just take one case, the Philippines, where the Philippine envoy to the United States happens to be Trump's business partner on buildings that he's building there. He flew to Trump Tower after the election for meetings with the Trump children, which we were all told was a business, not a diplomatic trip. And yet they're still planning to do more business together in the future.
Right. It's really sort of a head-spinning arrangement. I mean, to think that the guy that runs the Trump brand in the Philippines, where he just has completed the Trump Tower outside of Manila. And at the same time that guy is the envoy to the United States from the Philippines, there's great tensions between the United States and the Philippines right now. And then you have a guy who's a business partner with the envoy to the United States in the Philippines. That same envoy to the United States, who is his business partner, has also made clear that he's pursuing other deals with the Trump organization. So they're going to be, you know, having further arrangements that even further complicate the relationship.
So let's drill down on that just a little bit. I mean, what's the bigger risk here, that the president of the United States may have a fundamental conflict of interest between his own personal business interests and the interests of the United States, or that these deals could simply distort relations between the United States and important countries like the Philippines or Turkey or UAE or India or Brazil?
The biggest risk to me is that the government of the Philippines will expedite the permit on the next tower that Donald Trump organization or the Trump organization wants to build in the Philippines, because it thinks that if it does that, it would somehow get a better deal from the White House, and that therefore the White House won't, you know, criticize its human rights record, or that it will provide more military assistance simply because it's doing extra favors for the Trump organization. And there's no way that Donald Trump can really stop that. I mean, and he didn't necessarily request it. And he's not doing anything himself or his family that is inappropriate, but he's receiving a benefit that seems inappropriate because of the position of power he has. You know, say he's got a golf course with memberships that cost $50,000. Why wouldn't a government in some country that wants to impress the Trump family and, you know, buy up a bunch of memberships? Or say he's got a hotel in a city In Washington, where, you know, the diplomats, they'll pick his hotel because they want to say, even if he doesn't know about it, they want to send the signal that we like you, Mr. Trump, and we want your help to benefit our own agenda here in Washington.
And it should be said, Eric Lipton, I mean, as broad as your piece is, you've done them based on reporting and financial disclosures and just the fact that photographers can go up and take pictures of Trump Towers in a place like the Philippines. You don't know where the banks are that have lent money to Donald Trump, who he owes money to, and who the Trump Organization owes money to.
No, we know of engagements in at least 20 countries and with dozens of different deals. And it is not the whole list. In particular, he has not specified all of his lenders. And I mean, if you want to talk about someone that has leverage over you, to some extent, you know, a project that you built and that has your name on it and you got paid perhaps a fee or a commission to have your name on it is one thing. But if you owe someone $50 million, $100 million, you know, they have more leverage over you than someone you simply have a branding arrangement with. And we don't know who most of those loans are with because he did not disclose them and he's not required. He's required to disclose assets, and he did that in Federal Election Commission disclosure. He's going to have to do another disclosure in May of 2018. Although the Obama administration, when they came in, they did it the first year of their tenure in office, and he can choose whether or not he wants to do that.
So Donald Trump said in his sit down with the New York Times, he could easily run both his business and the country, but he's not going to do that. He's not going to be signing the checks anymore while he's president, hand that off to his children. But does that action dissolve the conflict of interest? I mean, he'll still know where his deals are. He'll know where his buildings are, and he'll still be talking to his children on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's definitely problematic. It's not a blind trust. And even if it were a blind trust because it's real estate, it doesn't really have the net effect of separating him from the potential conflict. So, I mean, you've had now, you know, the Wall Street Journal and others in the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal has called for him to take the radical step, which he presumably would never agree to, of actually liquidating all of his family holdings, taking the cash and then having someone invest that money that he doesn't have any insight into where that money is being invested. That would be a true blind trust. And then he could be president and no one could criticize him because he would not know what actions he's taking, what benefit it was bringing to any of his companies. But the way it's set up now is almost he might as well just run it himself. I mean, his children, his daughter has participated in, we know, at least three conversations with world leaders in Argentina, in Turkey, and in Japan. His sons are continuing to meet with business partners in various parts of the world. And his sons and daughters are on the transition team, and they're talking about having his son-in-law perhaps play an informal role in the administration. So the family and the business and the government continue to be entwined, even if Donald Trump is not signing the checks for the Trump Organization.
Eric, you know, before I let you go, there is a ton of criticism of the media, newspapers, cable outlets, radio shows after this election, a lot of it deserved, about the way the media handled the Trump phenomenon. And since your piece came out, a lot of people on television and even more of them on Twitter are saying to you and to your co-reporters, great piece, where the heck was this before the election? Why are you doing it now when the guy has his hands around the White House? How do you respond to that?
The short answer is yes, we could have done more. We should have done more. And, you know, there's always more that can be done. And I mean, but there's also a limit to the number of people and you know, the amount of time. And I wish we had done more and on both Hillary and on Donald Trump. But we did a lot of great stuff.
Eric Lipton is a Washington-based investigative reporter with our partner, The New York Times, who covered this story along with several other reporters. You can read that piece on NewYorkTimes.com.
Cuban Americans are gathering here at the Union of Cuban Ex-Political Prisoners, where the walls are lined with pictures of people killed during Fidel Castro's rule.
This is my friend. This was my friend. I know him here, yeah, because I've been in so many prisons.
It doesn't change the realities for the Cuban people. It doesn't change the realities of thousands who were tortured and jailed and who died.
I've never wanted to be back because of a dictatorship.
I feel so happy. After being 19 years in jail,
I thought that the day that this would happen, I'd be joyous and celebrating, but I can't because I don't want to celebrate a guy's death, but at the same time, I'm not lamenting for it.
I do plan on returning in the future. As far as involvement, now is the time, and it's definitely in the hands of the young people to take it over.
After this, Cuba have freedom for everybody, combat to Cuba.
It's not equivalent to liberty, but it's a step towards liberty.
Voices there over the weekend talking about the death of longtime Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Today is also a historic day for the U.S. and Cuba, the first commercial flight in decades between New York's JFK Airport and Havana. And it comes just as Cubans mark a 9-day mourning period for Castro, who died at 90 on Friday. Castro has been on the scene since 1959. Still, he leaves one of the world's most indelible legacies. To some, a revolutionary, anti-capitalist hero who stood up to president after U.S. president, but also a despot, a dictator who jailed political dissidents, jailed gay people, and presided over economic stagnation in Cuba. Julia Zweig is CBS News Cuba analyst and author of the book Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know. She says this is a monumental moment for Cuba and its future, the closing of a chapter that began when Castro jumped onto the political stage in his early 20s.
We're talking pretty much 70 years in which this man has played an outsized role in their lives. Now, the generational perspective is different. The older you get in Cuba, the more profound the impact he had. But even within Cuba and outside of Cuba, you know, he reshaped Latin American politics. He had a huge impact on the Cubans who left the island and on those who stayed. So it's a monumental and significant moment.
If you are Cuban and living under what we call the Castro regime, do things change rapidly or at all? There's already a great deal of change happening in Cuba economically and maybe socially. Does this signal more change or is this symbolic, his passing?
Well, I think, of course, it's symbolic, but he's been off the political stage for the better part of 10 years. During that time, as you say, there's been fairly significant change underway, led by his brother Raul. I'm not sure that it portends radical change, however. Cuba moves very cautiously and slowly when it comes to rewriting the social contract, which is what's been happening in the last several years. And now, especially, although the state, the government, the regime, there'll be more pressure on it to deliver opportunity and a better way of life for Cubans, especially for young Cubans. This death takes place against the backdrop of a huge political earthquake in the United States and President-elect Trump indicating, and we don't know yet, that he plans to potentially really overhaul the diplomatic and commercial opening of President Obama. And I think that factor is going to weigh on how rapidly or slowly the reform process advances now post-Fidel.
And when it comes to the United States and the changes happening here, it seems you have these countervailing forces. You have a Republican president-elect who has lots of constituents who want those reforms slowed down or parts of them reversed. You also have a hotel magnate, somebody with a real estate empire, who surely sees opportunity in Cuba or at least appreciates the economic opportunity available to people like him. It's not clear at all what he would really do when it comes to policy with a place that's ripe for such profit.
You're correct. And he had people on the ground looking into that opportunity in the last few years. So it depends which Donald Trump we get and who he appoints and whose influence he takes on or advice he takes on. I'm not so sure. There's one thing you said, Todd, that I think I disagree with, which is the constituents for rolling back the policy that Obama has put into place in the last 2 years are not as broad and deep as the coverage of the last few days suggests. Because what you have is now 80% increase in American travel year on year to Cuba. You have Cuban Americans, even those who might be delighted that Fidel is dead, investing in their families' small businesses on the islands, sending $3 to $4 billion in remittances a year. And then you have the hotel, the airline, the agriculture, the cruise industry, the universities, the museums. It is the breadth of engagement plus the government-to-government discussions is much bigger than I would describe as a narrow band, but a very articulate and loud and passionate band of opponents to the policy opening. He would have much more support, Mr. Trump, by recognizing that a year from now, Raul Castro is stepping down, and this potentially gives a Trump administration an opportunity, a choice. Do I want to roll back to the Cold War, pick a fight with a small Caribbean country, and maybe get a couple of points from that and some yayas out? Or do I want to reshape further the relationship with that country? I think we don't know where it's going to go, and despite the material suggestion otherwise.
And what is the plan domestically in Cuba? Raul Castro gives up power, at least he's supposed to, in a year, as you said. He's 85. It's not like he's the baby brother of Fidel Castro. Does it signal the potential for a real policy shift domestically in Cuba? Is there a plan for the post-Castro era there?
Well, there is a plan. I don't know if I would characterize it as a real policy shift. There's a designated successor. He's 56 years old. He's well-liked. He's an engineer by training. He has a lot of government experience outside of the capital, kind of as governor of two different provinces. There are strategic plans in place that the Communist Party has acted upon and endorsed in the last two party congresses, the most recent of which was this year, that still suggest a kind of modestly paced reform process in which you still have state socialism, but you have a market economy in the small business and cooperative sector and the state holding on to the big ticket items, economically speaking. And you have much more, I would say, autonomy from the state for Cubans than ever before, a more open society in terms of dialogue and speech than I've seen in the last 30 years I've been traveling there. But radical change, like if you envision Jimmy Carter going down there and running a multi-party democratic election process and the World Bank and the IMF overhauling the economy and turning it into a capitalist economy, full stop. No, I don't see that at all. It's more of a hybrid that will continue to evolve.
Julia Zweig, CBS News Cuba analyst. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Julia Zweig is author of the book Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know.
I knew we were immigrants, but I didn't understand being legal or illegal or what it meant to be a citizen or resident, or that I was neither. Now, with this presidential election and all the things Donald Trump has said about immigrants and deportations, it's clear that he doesn't care whether I came here as a child. He'd want me deported.
Andrea Bonilla came to the United States as an undocumented immigrant from Ecuador when she was just 5 years old. In 2012, her mother put in an application for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, that allows undocumented children and young adults who came as children to avoid deportation. Andrea Bonilla was here back in August talking about some of her fears if Donald Trump is elected president and deportation for her becomes a possibility.
Now that I've had DACA for years, I know how much I have to lose if it's taken away.
Si Trump ganara la presidencia.
I asked my mom, what would life be like if Trump became president and we had to move back to Ecuador?
No,
I don't want to think about that because our lives are here.
That's Bonilla speaking with her mother before the election. But Andrea Bonilla is now a college freshman studying film and media at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. She's excited about a future in America, but she's now facing a reality where she could be forced to return to Ecuador, a place she's never known as home.
We're like in limbo, and it's like very scary because even though we have this protection, is it going to last forever? Now with the new president, it looks like it won't.
So now with the election of the new president and everything that you've seen in the campaign, how are you feeling about your own position in this country, your ability to go to school? I mean, there's more uncertainty now, and I want to know how that affects you.
Well, at first, when I first heard it, like the next day for me, it wasn't just thinking about myself, but then thinking about so many other students, how I was lucky enough to like be able to attend college, and I'm in college now, but people before me, they won't get that opportunity, especially if DACA is taken away. And I definitely feel scared, but the president of my college has signed like this form saying that they're going to protect DACA students and undocumented students as much as they can. But then obviously there's people who don't want that. There was this Facebook post where like the president wrote her letter. And then there was comments saying, well, they shouldn't allow this. They're basically saying that people should just break the law. And it's unfair that the college money goes to these students. So that's definitely hurtful. And I know that those people that commented that stuff weren't the only people. And those are just people from my school, that there's people all around the country who like don't want us to be here. So that feels scary.
Just because somebody voted for Donald Trump doesn't necessarily mean they don't want you around. But for some people, it does mean that. Yeah. So as you go around town in Easton, in Northampton County, Pennsylvania, how are you viewing your neighbors, the people around town, and how do you think they view you?
I like just in my campus, I feel like obviously I'm the minority there. And I don't know, because sometimes like I see like direct acts, like people who obviously don't want us there. Like my school, some people were putting up posters against Trump and they were just taking them down. And then so obviously I'm like, I'm not welcomed here and people like me are not welcomed here. And I feel like, I guess, alone, especially being there, because there's not people like me a lot.
Are you concerned that you could be deported?
I mean, some people tell me not to be because, like, I'm a student. But I feel like I definitely have that fear in the back of my mind.
Now, what about other people in your family?
I think they're obviously scared. But at the end of the day, they've always said that they're more scared for me because they've lived their life. And what matters for them is me, like, pursuing my dreams and, like, opportunities that I have here.
So your fears and concerns about possibly being deported, I mean, we've talked about this before and it's a real concern. But you're here, you're studying, you want to have a career. What do you want to contribute in this country? Who do you want to be? I think it's important for people to hear about what your dreams and aspirations are and who you want to be for this country.
Well, I definitely want to, like, help better this country. And I just want to show that, like, even though people think, like, Hispanic people, like, don't go to college and all they do is bring crime and all this stuff, like, I just want to show them that that's not how it is. Like, what I want to do is pursue film and media and, like, be somebody in this world and make films, like, for the big screen one day. And, like, I want to be just like everybody else, just like people's kids. The only difference is that I was brought here when I was 5 years old and I didn't even have a choice in that. So it wasn't my decision and, like, I just want to do good stuff.
Do you have midterms yet at school?
Yeah, I did.
How'd you do?
I did actually good. I got 2 A's and 1 B+.
2 A's and 1 B+ in midterms at Lafayette College. Andrea Bonilla, congratulations.
Thank you.
Andrea Bonilla is a DACA recipient. She's a freshman at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, in Northampton County, and a former radio rookie and return guest here on The Takeaway. Andrea, thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. This year, outside groups spent a record amount of money in judicial elections. $19 million of outside money poured into races across 27 state Supreme Courts. That's according to a new report out from the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. Now, that's a jump of 44% over the 2012 cycle. And most of this is dark money. That means donors and their connections are hidden from the public. And for many, it's a troubling sign that courts at the state level are falling under increasing political pressure. Alicia Bannon is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, and she joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Alicia.
Hello. Thank you.
So who are the dark money groups and the donors that we're talking about in these judge races? Are these your typical super PACs with tons of dark money behind them?
Yep. So we see a lot of so-called social welfare organizations. So those are groups that don't need to disclose their donors at all, as well as super PACs that themselves receive a lot of money from other groups. So you have to kind of unpeel an onion to figure out who's behind the money. It's typically groups on the right. They've been the main source of a lot of this spending.
What are they trying to get for their money?
Well, I think that they're trying to shape who sits on these courts and ultimately the decisions that these courts are making. So I think in some cases there's a kind of broad interest in shifting the ideological composition of a court. Sometimes judges are being targeted for particular decisions that are unpopular or controversial.
So where are the places in the country, there are probably many you could point to, where these shifts, where this money has been the most important in changing the ideological scope of a court to a way that would really make a difference to groups like this?
Well, I mean, we've seen courts around the country shift. So this goes all the way back to the late 80s and early 90s, where Alabama and Texas were initially kind of targeted. Those were states where their courts were Democratic controlled. And over the course of about a decade, they moved to entirely Republican controlled courts. In more recent years, we've seen efforts in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, all states where the courts have shifted their ideological composition. And these state courts are really important. So they're hearing cases on redistricting. They're hearing cases about reproductive rights. They're hearing cases about the rights of consumers and businesses, environmental suits. So there's a lot of high stakes decisions that these courts are making that really has a big impact on businesses' interests as well as the politics of a state.
Is a solution needed here? And on a practical basis, what would it be?
Well, I think there's a lot that states can do to address these issues. I mean, first off, I think states do need to step back and rethink how they're choosing judges, especially looking on the back end where judges are not only having to face elections, but then face re-elections. So then they're going on the ballot repeatedly, and that means the decisions that they are making are essentially being put to public referenda time and time again. And so I think certainly states need to be rethinking how they're approaching choosing judges in the first place. I think also there's a lot that you can do to address dark money, you know, stronger disclosure laws. You could also provide public financing for candidates so they don't need to do their own fundraising from interests who are frequently appearing before the court. So I think there's a lot that states can do.
Shifting the ideological balance of courts all across the United States. Alicia Bannon is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. Thank you.
Thank you.
Scientists and governments across the globe are sounding the alarm about man-made climate change. Still, skeptics remain at the highest levels of government here in the United States. But climate change isn't the first global environmental movement. For that, you have to go back 35 years to the moment the planet suddenly became aware of the rainforest.
At the beginning of the 80s, there was not a whole lot of attention to deforestation in the Amazon. When it began to kind of attract more attention was precisely when remote sensing scientists began using satellite images to show what was going on from space.
We can locate above 7,000 fires every day.
That's Stephen Schwartzman. He's Senior Director of Tropical Forest Policy for the Environmental Defense Fund, speaking in the latest documentary by the team at Retro Report. Now, this week, Retro Report looks back at the origins of the modern Save the Rainforest movement and its impact on environmental activism today. Retro Report producer Jeffrey O'Connor says the origins of the rainforest movement can actually be traced to the murder of a previously unknown Brazilian union activist named Francisco Chico Mendes.
So Chico Mendes was a Brazilian rubber tapper. In other words, he and many others living in the state of Acre in the Amazon were extracting latex from trees. He was one of the founders of a union of rubber tappers. He advocated for the preservation of the rainforest, for what are called extractive reserves. And those efforts by Chico and his colleagues created a lot of tension within his area, particularly with cattle ranchers. And ultimately, because of his efforts to save the rainforest, he was assassinated by local cattle ranchers. And that triggered a kind of international media storm in which people really started to wake up to this idea that, you know, the rainforest was on the line.
So let's hear from Larry Cox, who's in your story. He's former executive director of the Rainforest Foundation.
What was at stake was not only the future of the people in the Amazon. Westerners were convinced that their future also was invested. That's what was fueling the kind of environmental movement at that time.
I think the environmental community really saw the kind of impact that Chico's death had, and they started reaching out for partnerships with the indigenous peoples of the rainforest. And that's where Sting came into the picture, and he started to collaborate with the Kayapo Indians and with one sort of extraordinary village leader by the name of Raoni. And they literally went on a world tour, world concert tour, raising money to demarcate, to establish boundaries around the lands of the Kayapo. Those are protective boundaries. Those are boundaries that are recognized by the Brazilian government, and they're essentially a line in the sand where loggers and gold miners can't cross and can't extract minerals or wood from the lands of the Kaiapo.
What lessons are there in the story that you've told here about rainforest preservation and how popular it was in the late 80s to climate change today, do you think?
You know, I think the real lesson from that time period is about collaboration. And it's about collaboration with these communities in tropical forests around the world. You can't have a top-down strategy in terms of environmental preservation unless you're cooperating with these groups.
And what's the state of rainforest protection and that movement in Brazil and other countries today?
Well, I think, you know, speaking of communities, I mean, you have – it's a very difficult time in Brazil right now. There's the – Brazilian economy is in a recession. There's a lot of pressure now to develop the Amazon as a cure-all for the Brazilian economy. And what you're seeing is an increase in the numbers of individuals who are either involved in environmental preservation or land reform movements being assassinated. Since 2002, there have been over 500 of these people assassinated in the Brazilian Amazon. It's a frontier area. There aren't institutions of justice. So what you need to have in place is, you know, very inventive practices in order to protect the rainforest.
Jeffrey O'Connor is freelance producer for CNN, for BBC, and for Retro Report. You can see his film on RetroReport.com and on the New York Times website on the history of the environmental movement and protection of the Brazilian Amazon rainforest. Jeffrey O'Connor, thanks.
Thank you.
Maya Angelou was a voice that pushed artistic and racial boundaries for three generations. She opened the eyes and ears of millions of people to continuous struggle and survival for an African-American woman. She was prolific during her 86 years, singer, dancer, civil rights activist, although most people who knew Maya Angelou discovered her as a poet and a writer. Works like And Still I Rise and I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings helped Angelou give voice to her own life, but also helped generations of African-Americans, thinkers and writers, find their voices as well. Bob Hercules and Rita Coburn-Wack recount the life of the cultural icon in a new documentary called Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. And in it, they weave together Angelou's broad and artistically varied life using her own writings and appearances to narrate. The film starts with Angelou as a young child when she and her brother moved across the country from Los Angeles to live with her grandmother in the rural segregated town of Stamps, Arkansas. And it was the first place where Maya Angelou learned the painful truth of growing up as a black girl in the Jim Crow South.
When she had to go in the white part of town, even as a little child, she chose to stiffen her back, grit her teeth, and get through it. Because walking in the town, she was looked at with disdain. And that's something that happens in the culture in the South, that it's an unnecessary insult. I'm already a woman. I'm a girl child. I'm already black. And the racism that you feel toward me as really a child, it ruins my childhood. It makes me have to think as a person who has to always be on top of a defense mechanism or to create one or to be crushed by it. And I think what she chose was the words that we start the film off with, and I think it started there.
We may encounter many defeats, but we must not be defeated. That, in fact, it may be necessary to encounter defeats so we can know who the hell we are.
And she had to walk that way through her life after rape, after all these kind of injustices, and not be defeated, and in the process, find her voice and use it.
Let's talk about the awful chapter, the ultimate insult and the ultimate crime that Maya Angelou suffered as a 7-year-old girl, which was being raped by an adult man. And in addition to the trauma and the scars, one of the sequelae of that crime was that the assailant wound up dead.
It was so traumatic to her because she thought, if I talk, more people will die. And so she stopped talking for 5 years. She went mute. Yet what she did was she read and she listened for those 5 years. And so she accumulated an incredible body of knowledge from reading, you know, all the sonnets of Shakespeare and Edgar Allan Poe and all the classics. She read all those books, and it really, I think, profoundly affected her life, as, of course, the trauma did.
Bob Hercules, a lot of people now who may have been exposed to Maya Angelou for the first time, let's say at a presidential inauguration in the 90s, may not have known that she was what would have been called a real radical in the 60s during civil rights.
Absolutely. She was very good friends with Malcolm X, for instance, both in New York and also when she lived in Ghana. Malcolm X came, of course, to Ghana and to some other African countries, and they bonded even stronger when she was living there. He was on his the road to Mecca, and he was in Ghana for a while. And also, she worked for a while for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She was the Northern coordinator here in New York, actually, in the early 60s. And so she got to know Martin Luther King quite well. She was pretty radical. There was a case where Patrice Lumumba, the president of the Congo, was assassinated, probably with some CIA meddling in the background. They took that, the black community at the time took that as an affront, not only to Africans, but also to African Americans. And so she was very involved in a protest at the United Nations. It became quite a scene where people were throwing punches, and she always said, you know, you got to take it to the streets. She told her son, you know, if you have a strong belief in justice and what's right in the world, you have to act on it.
Rita, there was this transformation later in life for Maya Angelou from radical to popular writer to really matriarch and someone I think of as almost a secular saint toward the end of her career. Can you describe how that transformation took place and how she perceived a sort of this elevation and this matriarchal role that she had later in life?
I think that in the 60s, when she really came into her own, she was working with a lot of people, both white and black, who believed that they could attain freedom, that it was about to be born. And as Bob said, she worked with both Malcolm X and with Martin Luther King, and they were diametrically opposed as to how to achieve something. But she was able to stay in the middle, and she was able to outlive most of these people. They died in their 30s, and she lived to be 86. And she never gave up the hope that reconciliation, forgiveness, and what Dr. King called the beloved community could become attainable. In the middle of that, she reinvented herself with every new thing. And what we have to remember is, if you traveled in the State Department, with the State Department, with Porgy and Bess in the 50s, you got to see a part of the world. She got to see things that made her say things like, people are more alike than unalike. Her eyes were open. She found love across racial lines and had two marriages with white men. And so, coming from the Jim Crow South, she kept reinventing herself. So later on, when people began to look up to her and began to hear her words and see wisdom in them, and then during that inaugural poem, she was able to step into that sense of reinvention. And a lot of people live in the past, and I don't think she lived in the past. She lived in her present.
Bob Hercules, it is rare, as Rita just suggested, for an artist, especially a very vital artist when they're younger, to stay vital in old age, to stay relevant, forget about popular, even as youth and society kind of, you know, move past them. That never seemed to happen with Maya Angelou.
She was always relevant in our society, even up to right before she passed in 2014. She weighed in on all the big issues of the day. There's a great scene in the film where she talks about the N-word with Common and a few other cases of that.
It's vulgar. It's created to demean a human being. I know black people say, I can use it because I'm black. No, no. If a thing is poison and it's got a skull and bones on it, you can take that content and pour it into Bavarian crystal. It's still poison.
If she were alive today, obviously she'd weigh in very strongly about Donald Trump being president or being president-elect.
Bob Hercules, could you hear Maya Angelou having optimism or hope for the coming presidency, for the coming years? Forget about elections for a moment, but for where the country goes from here.
Well, I think she was always at the core an optimistic person. I mean, she overcame enormous obstacles. The primary thing that she always talked about was courage. This was a very courageous woman, and I think she would tell us to also be courageous, to take on whatever comes down the pike with this Trump presidency and take action, be organized, don't take it lying down. And that's the only way that things can be changed. And she was an agent of change her whole life. So were she alive, she'd be in the thick of it again.
Bob Hercules, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Todd.
And Rita Coburn-Wack, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Rita Coburn-Wack and Bob Hercules are both directors of Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. It's out now. So did you buy anything on Black Friday? Hey, a deliciously evil game called Cards Against Humanity celebrated Black Friday by digging a huge crowdfunded hole in the ground, a holiday hole. A $5 donation got you 2 seconds of dig time. That hole raised $100,000 and is big enough to fit a house. And that is what we call a quality take on Black Friday. Hey, happy Cyber Monday. Thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.